Hello, I'm Daniel Christenwall, author of Designing Regenerative Cultures.
And I'm Philippa Duffy, Oceania Director at the RSA. You're listening to Series 2 of Regeneration Rising, a podcast exploring how we can create a thriving home for all on our planet. In this conversation, we're delighted to be joined by Indigenous musician, scholar, and community organizer, Dr. Lila June Johnston. Drawing on her Diné, Cheyenne, and European lineages, Lila blends her study of human ecology at Stanford, graduate work in Indigenous pedagogy, and the traditional worldview she grew up with to inform her music, perspectives, and solutions.
In the beginning, there was the word. Flares of white fire burning in the void. Her sparkling phosphoric dream, escaping through the chasms of rebellion. Her scintillating fountain of love, defying the laws of silence. Holographic refractions of her wild imagination, searing through the night in 5 trillion directions. Finally coming to rest in the marrow of our bones. We are the supernova that exploded long ago.
Lila, thank you so much for being here. You recently completed your doctoral thesis on Indigenous food and land management systems, which you titled Architects of Abundance, to reflect the active role pre-colonial Indigenous peoples in the Americas had in shaping their landscape. Can you tell us more about your research and what you discovered?
Yeah, I was really surprised to see in my research the extent to which Indigenous peoples managed the what we now call the Americas, but we call it Turtle Island, this continent that so many thousands of different Native nations have called home for so many tens of thousands of years. And the general depiction of Indigenous peoples is that they are sparsely populated nomads, kind of eking a living out of the land, looking for a berry to eat or a deer to hunt. That's the narrative that I was spoon-fed as a child, even as a Native woman. The dominant culture really told me who I was and who my people were. So this research really helped me to bust that myth and help me see how we had an extreme influence and an extensive influence in how the land looked and tasted. Everything from really creating with our bare hands these chestnut groves that grew from Maine down to Georgia. Really looking at the ways in which we created and maintained entire grassland ecosystems with the routine burning of the prairies. And our lunar calendar in the fall, you know, it's called the grass burning moon. The September moon is often called the grass burning moon for those nations that live in that area. The clam gardens that we would augment habitat for these clams for kilometers and kilometers and kilometers across the Pacific Northwest, and just looking at all the beautiful food systems that Indigenous peoples, really the world over, but of course my focus was here in what we call America, because I had such an important job to do to rewrite the narrative for my people. But yeah, just looking at ways in which, you know, not only correcting the record about what we call Native Americans or Indigenous peoples of Turtle Island, you know, that we created this, but also poking a hole in the story that humans are pests. Humans are constantly a problem, and really showing like, actually there's been many, many human societies in the past that have been extremely good to the earth. So good to the earth that if they were to leave, she would actually miss us. So good to the earth that their presence actually improved the land. Not only didn't hurt it, but actually improved the biodiversity, the balance of these systems, the prolific nature of different food systems that were not only designed to feed humans, but designed to feed all life. So that's really what my dissertation is about, is number one, showing how Native peoples, you know, wielded a very respectful yet immense influence upon the land here. And number two, like what that means for humanity in general, that we have the capacity to be extremely beneficial to the land.
Laila, one thing that I find fascinating is that you point towards, on the one hand, decentering the human in the design practice of like, where do we fit within the larger ecosystem that we actually help into higher states of abundance. And then you also point out, which I really love what you've just done, that we are actually a critically important keystone species on this planet, and that to bow out now in with regard to climate change and say, well, we started it, but now next generation or somebody else has to fix it. We human beings have a critical role in readdressing the balance that we imbalanced, particularly the perpetrator nations in the global north. But this is another thing that you do so beautifully. You address all the issues that need addressing regarding decolonialization, but you remind people that we're all indigenous to life and that we're all capable of coming back to that regenerative capacity that human beings have. Could you speak a little bit about the healing between the human family to actually step into that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are all indigenous, and I also don't think we're all indigenous to where we're standing. And I think that's an important discernment, because if we, for example, in the United States, if everyone's like, oh, we're all indigenous to the earth, then we never have to grapple with the land theft. We never have to, it's sort of a bypass, you know, it's like, oh, well, we're all indigenous, we don't have to deal with it. I do absolutely agree that we are all indigenous to somewhere. And in my case, I'm indigenous to a couple different places. More and more people are so mixed race, they have indigenous roots in a lot of different places. But I do want to make that discernment, because I think it behooves us, wherever we are, to follow the indigenous peoples of the land that we're standing on. And in addition to following them, because they arguably have the science of that land most dialed in, also working towards reparations for whosoever's lands we're standing on. Because it's not just about healing the biosphere, which of course it is, but it's also about healing history and ceasing to be part of the legacy of colonization. And to me, the only way to cease being a part of that legacy is to acknowledge our role as guests on indigenous lands that are coming with humility and gentleness and a willingness to listen and an excitement to be a partner to indigenous nations in a way that's letting them often lead a lot more than we do. So it's so important to re-inhabit regeneratively. And I hope that's what my work is showing, is that we can do this. I think that has to be guided by, first and foremost, a very specific set of values, which are not that complicated, but very powerful. And those are almost universally across these sustainable indigenous food systems, the values of respect, reverence, responsibility, reciprocity, relationality. All these happen to be R words. I don't know why. But there's also other ones like treating all life as equal. You know, this notion that we are all equal. The plants are not our slaves. The birds and the animals are not our slaves. They are our relatives. So when guided by those principles, if you give those principles enough time to operate in yourself and on the land, I think we will naturally heal the earth. That these principles, these values are paramount. because you could have the exact same technologies as these ancient native societies, like the clam gardens, but hand it to someone driven by capitalistic values. It's not going to work. It's just going to be destroyed again. I think I've come to the conclusion that the values have primacy overall. That is the causal root, where it all starts, is the invisible world of our values. Just like a tree, you can see the trunk, the branches, the leaves, and you think, okay, that's society. But what you don't see is what's working underneath, what's operating under the hood, is the roots, is actually powering the whole thing. And so similarly, I think the things we don't see in our society, the invisible world of our hearts and our minds, is what's powering this whole thing. And that's not to say it's our actions are important. Our physical manifestation of things, our design is important. And those even in turn affect values. but it is deeply, like, until we get those values right, I don't think we're going to see the change we need. And I do want to say something that I'm half European and half native. So I always had a lot of inner reconciliation to do, especially being brought up in a community where to be white was a negative thing. You know, most people in my community were brown. So there was a lot of shame for being white. And granted, as Europeans, we have created a lot of harm, to say the least. I mean, inexplicable, ineffable harm. And at the very same time, we have to look a little deeper at the context in which that harm was generated. Europe experienced about 2,000 years of open warfare before Columbus was ever born. We have the prohibition of indigenous European languages. As recently as 1920, you weren't allowed to speak Welsh in school. And if you did, you would get a block of wood tied around your neck with the letters WN written on it, which stood for Welsh knot. And the only way you could get this block of wood off of your neck is if you caught another kid speaking Welsh. And so there's all the tactics that we as Europeans then continued forth and perpetuated in other places were first practiced on us. It was almost like a testing ground for all of this mayhem that our European ancestors experienced. But equally important, if you look deeper, you know, I went to the caves in France where you have 17,000-year-old cave paintings of ibex, of buffalo, you know, bison, of horse, that look remarkably like the drawings you see in what we call the Americas. And of course, these societies were brought to their knees much in the same way that my mother's people here in Turtle Island, you know, United States, how her people were brought to their knees. It's very much whatever was close to the earth, whatever was close to Creator was targeted, you know, by coyote spirit. And coyote in my mother's culture is a trickster, and it doesn't like, you know, those things that are close to Creator, that are evolved, and it targets them, it hunts them down. So I think indigenous European culture, the regenerative, you know, the same burning practices that we see here in Turtle Island, we see evidence of in Norway, we see evidence of in Scotland. So the regenerative practice that we see here at Turtle Island was also going on in Europe at different stages. And as hard as it is for my native, indigenous side on my mom's side, as hard as it is for us to connect with our culture because of what America did to us through the boarding schools, through language prohibition, through massacres, and it's almost even harder for Europeans to remember their indigenous culture because it's buried under even more centuries of annihilation. That's something we have to consider and heal from and grieve and love ourselves through so that we cease to perpetuate it to others.
Just thinking back to the values you mentioned earlier, Lila, One of our upcoming guests, Tyson Yunker-Porter, who's an Australian Aboriginal academic, originally from North Queensland, in his book Sand Talk, Tyson talks about how our societal issues really stem from what he calls the original sin of human exceptionalism. So placing ourselves above the land, above other species and entities. And in terms of that cycle of violence and trauma that you've just identified, do you also feel it stems, as Tyson suggests, from that false sense of superiority?
Yeah, I think he's right to name supremacism as a root cause of a lot of mayhem and a lot of imbalance. Supremacism is not just white supremacy, it's male supremacy, which we also know as patriarchy. And then, of course, human supremacy. This notion that for some weird, arbitrary reason, humans are just more important than everything else. And why did supremacism arise? Like, what makes someone feel the need to be better than something else? And of course, there's the answer of like, oh, well, they want our land. So in order to get our land, they have to contrive some kind of license to dominate, which, as he said, is often, I'm better than you. And I'm smarter than you, and you're not really using this land anyways, so give it to me, you know. That is definitely something that people often have used throughout time. But even then, maybe we should go even deeper than that. Like, why do people want other people's land, you know? And I think it really does go back to that trauma that I spoke of Europe being in a state of war for centuries on end. And it's not just Europe who exhibited dominating behaviors and who was, creating caste systems in the world. And there's also here in what we call Turtle Island, what we call the Americas, some people, we had a lot of different nations overpowering one another at different stages in history. And luckily, we learned from it. You know, we would collapse almost inevitably, whether it's the Mayan civilizations or Chaco. But we see it more as like we learned a lesson. And yes, we collapsed, but we stood back up. And we stood back up a wiser people and a better people. But the original point I was saying is that why do people even seek to dominate in the first place? And I really do think the root of that is trauma. Supremacism is not an act of bravery. It's an act of insecurity. To say I am greater than someone, why? Why would anyone ever need to say I'm better than him or I'm better than them or I'm better than all species? It, only if you're insecure, only if you feel some pain, need to prove yourself, right? And so narcissists, Trump is a perfect example, has to be on top, has to be the big manly guy, you know, clearly was never enough for someone somewhere. Clearly some sort of deep, deep spiritual wound manifesting as supremacism. So I think what I'm trying to say is at the end of the day, a lot of this boils down to trauma, personal trauma in the microcosm, but is also a trend for a lot of people, which then manifests as a larger macrocosm of just exuding our traumatized behavior over, sadly, the earth. And to me, that's Coyote's plan. Coyote likes that.
I'm wondering, from your understanding of the worldviews and world, like the narratives of First Nations people in North America and other parts of the world, the narrative of I own this land as opposed to I am expression of this land. What's your sense around this shift from all my relations, I'm an expression of life itself, and life will flow through me and will continue beyond this embodied state to this piece of turf is my piece of turf and I have the right to fence it and defend it against somebody else.
Yeah. Well, I talked a lot about what was wrong, but I also didn't talk a little bit about what was right. So if insecurity is the root cause of domination, what's the opposite of that? You know, is trust in yourself, knowing that you are whole, knowing that you are going to be cared for, you're taken care of. You know, a lot of the world's wisdom teachings talk about faith, you know, faith in nature, faith in the creator to provide for you. That wisdom is really important to know that everything's going to be okay. You know, I don't need to hoard today. I will be taken care of tomorrow. And so I think similarly with your question of, you know, when did we go from, oh, I'm rooted in reality and I am an expression of sacred reality to like, let me own other parts of reality and claim it as my own. I think the answer to that is different depending on your context. I know in Europe, like I said, it's war. And not just a little bit of war. We're talking layers and layers. And I mean, there's like 20 massive documented periods of bloodshed in Spain alone in the past few thousand years. I mean, when you have that much war, again, you're going to have fear. That's the opposite of faith. I'm not going to be taken care of tomorrow. Let me fence this in. And they went through a lot of mental gymnastics to justify private property, first in Rome and then in the UK. And I could get into that. It's actually very related to the topic of native land management and why that was erased. Because they said if somebody works the land, then they own it. Because you can't own the land, that's creator's creation, but you own your labor. So if you toil and plow and you sow seeds, then it's your use it or lose it kind of thing. If you're using it, it's yours. So when they saw all these native people using the land, they wanted to diminish that as much as possible because by their own laws, that meant that these native people owned the land. So they painted us more as hunter-gatherers wandering around, not really using the land. But in the indigenous context, you know, you could ask the same question, why were folks turfing? Why were they? And I think it's very different. But what I do understand is in the indigenous context, there was a lot of sacred, quote unquote, sacred hierarchies, which is an oxymoron, right? Any form of hierarchy is asinine, right? But I know that the turf wars were different in what we now call the Americas. They were really, I want to say, like religiously based. They weren't so secular. They weren't so imperial. They were more, because we were such spiritual people, Coyote had to find a way to fit that hierarchy into our spiritual practice. And that's my theory. And so a lot, the mound builders, the Chaco Canyon people, you know, you had the high priests, you know, were always on top. So I think it's, again, going back to insecurity, but in those worlds, it wasn't just the coveting of land. It was also, I believe, coveting status, you know, reputation. So that's one of the things that the elders tell us, never do anything for money and never do anything for reputation. Those are our foundational teachings. So we forgot that a lot. And our turf wars were not just about getting land. They were about reputation. And invariably, whenever we got to the top and we finally reached God, God always knocked us down and obliterated those societies. Like the mound builders had huge catastrophic events that, you know, brought the whole civilization to their knees. So did the Chacoans. We always got humbled in the best of ways. And then we became egalitarian. So from Chaco, you have me. I'm a descendant of those Chaco people. We're very equal. Every clan is equal. From the mound builders, you have people like the Muscogee, who humility and meekness is their primary principles, to be meek, you know, the exact opposite of wanting to be on top. from the Mayan civilization, they actually vacated that place on their own. They were like, what are we doing? You know, they were one of the people who actually left of their own accord. No catastrophe, no nothing. They're like, we are not God. And so they're kind of a special society. They became more egalitarian. So we always, I think the turf wars were different in other words. And I don't know if that answers your question, but hopefully it offers some color to the whole conversation.
Absolutely. And you earlier said we always learned from collapse and came a wiser people. And it just struck me because it rings so strongly where we are at now due to the actions of a small proportion of humanity with regard to the processes already unfolding with regard to climate change that will mean the cascading collapse of ecosystems and many of the structures people are now taking for granted. And so I think the next 3 to 4 to 5 decades, possibly even generations, will be a time of understanding and reframing collapse as a liberating of patterns in order for new things to be born. And how do you also, because now that finally more and more people are waking up to the importance of indigenous wisdom in all aspects of life in terms of living in right relationships, how would you see indigenous wisdom informing this collapsing Western globalized society as we shift from what Joanna Macy called the industrial growth society to the life-sustaining society again?
Yeah, I think it's like everything is connected, right? We all know that now. We're starting to know that now. Everything is interrelated. And we've been punching our own mother every time we build a mine and we mine her crystalline heart. We're punching her. Every time we dump radioactive waste in the ocean, we're punching her. Every time we consume and deposit however many tons of plastic we create every day, we're punching her. And so we haven't felt that punch because we've been the puncher. But in an interconnected system, the puncher inevitably is also the punchee. You know, you're gonna feel it. And we have somehow managed to postpone feeling it as much as possible to the point where now it has to take a global systems transformation, upheaval, collapse for us to feel the consequences of our punching. But I often say the collapse started a long time ago. Even though we're just feeling it now, it started a long, you could argue decades, you could argue even centuries, you could probably argue millennia. It started a long time ago, and we're just finally feeling the aftermath of it. The moment we thought it was okay to destroy an entire mountain to get something we thought we needed, to mine it out, when there was everything we needed was already here. You know, that's to me when the collapse started. The moment we decided to put a dam up in a river where all these salmon were no longer able to swim upstream, and we thought that was a good idea. We could do better than the rivers because we're smarter, we're faster, we're God, you know. We're just seeing the face of it now, but it's been with us the whole time. And yeah, kind of reframing that, reframing collapse from big scary thing that should be avoided at all costs to actually maybe this is our gift, you know. In Chaco, we say Creator gave us a gift of a drought to give us the courage to change because nothing else would. And so sometimes a drought is the only thing that will wake Homo sapiens up. They need to feel it directly. And we're very much about weighing costs and benefits of our actions. And so far, the benefit of having an industrial fossil fuel based society we haven't had any costs. You know, we're just like, woo, let's go. Press the gas, let's go. And so once we feel those costs, only then will we And it's kind of unfortunate that that's how immediate our brains have been working. And it would behoove us to go back to a place where we see the benefits of this next seven generations as important, and we see the costs of the next seven generations as important. And we're not just doing these, oh, what's it going to look like next fiscal quarter? You know, like that's not going to work. So yeah, I think this collapse is, I don't like it. I wish it wasn't happening. I wish we had the strength or the guidance or something to help us choose differently. But at this point, I don't think there's anything else that could wake us up, perhaps. But don't get me wrong. I'm going to keep fighting. I'm going to go down swinging. I'm going to keep trying and do everything I can to prevent it. But until we, as a species, really decide a different way, I don't know if there's another outcome possible.
Thinking about what motivates us to act in the way that we currently are, one of the guests on our webinar series for season one, Giles Hutchins, said that we're suffering from what he described as a crisis of love. And I think Nora Bateson points to that also in the last episode when she says that, you know, fundamentally, humans just want to be loved. They want to feel safe and seen and wanted. And most of all, they want to know that they belong, that they have a home somewhere. And I think somewhere along the way, in disconnecting from the land, perhaps, we've lost that fundamental sense of belonging to a place, that notion that we are of a place, that we belong to a certain land. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts around that notion of a crisis of love.
Yeah, I mean, love is, I think, actually our nature. And so I think you're right that this crisis of love, it starts in the formative years of a human being. You have to put a child through quite a bit of trauma to set them in a different track away from love. And sadly, children go through it every day. And it pains me, you know, and I also went through it, and I'm lucky that, for some weird reason, I kept choosing love and I kept seeking love despite so much abuse and despite so much, abuse as a child. I wish I could say it was easy to untangle that really hard ball of tangled stuff to set ourselves free, to love ourselves, and to stop hurting others because we've been hurt. And then, of course, there's the macro, where over time, and that's, I think, what war does, is it manages to give that trauma to like a whole population all at once, you know, and it seeds that fear. And war, they say, is one of the most powerful tools in the hands of coyote, because it can just shock a whole community or communities of communities. And that trauma can take generations to untangle and to stand back up. Like, and it's sort of like when you have more work than you can do, but that you can physically be expected to complete, you know, but then another load of work comes on and it's just burying us in this backlog of stuff that we have yet to process. And that's from war, you know, that's from war and state sanctioned gender violence. You know, that's really what a lot of us are suffering from. So yes, I agree that love is everything. And by the same token, as gnarly and challenging as violence and war is, grace is always going to be more powerful. And I think that's our task as humans, is to apply grace to each other as much as we can, and to ourselves. And despite all the hardcore things I've been talking about on this episode, I have immense hope. I have immense hope in the fact that, you know, we are going to get to a place where we are going to learn very strong lessons just like the Chuck Owens learned when they collapsed, we're going to learn stuff that's going to stay with us for eons and eons. We're going to learn how important love was all along, how important women and honoring women was all along, how important the tiniest ant and the ecology and the fragility and the balance of this earth was all along.
You speak with such conviction of this because you've lived a reason to be hopeful in your own story. I mean, you had a pretty rough childhood and youth, and you've stepped into such strength, not just as a brilliant scientist, but as an artist, as a poet. And I feel like a lot of what you just shared is so strong because it comes from experience. How important is poetry and music for you now and for us in maybe being able to process these things better than we ever could with an academic degree, for example?
I mean, music is one of the gifts of the creator, I feel. And every culture has it. And it's a very unique thing to our species, although a lot of species make music, but we seem to be one of those species that can't seem to live without it. And every culture around the world has its own music. That's one thing that unifies humanity. We all sing. Like every last culture on the planet sings. And that's one word that you'll find in all of our languages is to sing, to chant, to turn this talking voice into a singing voice. And that is, you know, I guess a way to tap into, you could say it, our primordial design, or you could say it just as, you know, creator made us this way. So it's an avenue to tap into all of us. But what we call music in the English language has, you know, its presence in every single culture around the world. And so there's obviously something to be said about music being a tool to impart wisdom that sticks. But can we leverage the tool of music to have people remember really important things, you know, about who they are, about what they are, about what the earth is. And so you have a responsibility and a power as a musician. When you create a song, you are creating something that could possibly be remembered by a lot of people. So make sure you're saying something that's gonna help, because there's a power in it that has been abused, as we all know. Music can be a tool of liberation. It can be a tool of enslaving a whole culture to these really damaging norms. So yeah, it's a very powerful tool. Poetry as well. I mean, it's something that it helps to get the soul opened up and the mind opened up to ideas, concepts, patterns that can, If the mind can envision it, then we can create it, you know? So to me, poetry is a lot, different types of poetry, but mine is a lot about painting a picture, painting a very beautiful picture that if we can see it in our mind's eye, then we can create it in the world. And so I'm thinking about my poem Hojo, which is all about me and my grandmother, and being connected to the land, being connected to our prayer, and to this concept of Hojo, of beauty and joy, and how that's the heart of Indigenous peoples. So when I say that poem, it really hits people because now they know of a whole world that they didn't know about before, a whole world of Indigenous culture, and they're like, oh, okay, this is a whole worldview, a whole cosmology that is so wonderful and worth saving, worth protecting. And I get to represent my people just a tiny bit out in the world and be like, hey, this is who we are. So yeah, I think music and poetry has that capacity to break open stuff that a scientific paper does not have the capacity to do. When I close my eyes at night, I can feel the rock being cut open by water. I hear a grandfather's song, and it sounds like sand walking down the river bottom. In this song, they talk about how even the mighty canyon walls were formed by meandering streams. Beneath the gentle waters, there are people. Not people like you and I, stone people. When I close my eyes at night, I am one of them, and God is the water. Over lifetimes, she eats away at me until I am polished and smooth. She teaches me about being gentle and persistent. She teaches me about patience and commitment. When I close my eyes, she speaks to me in this language of trickles and bubbles, and she says, journeys, take them, and try to remember who you are along the way. I have nothing for you but these words. Take them with you, and I will see you again when you arrive at the ocean's throne as 1 million kernels of sand. Her voice hums in my blood, quiet as a stream in the night. And it is this song about how we are all just so loved. The eagles dip their talons into her soft body and pull from it a fish, a flesh meal for their children. They sing this grandfather's song with her, and it sounds like feathers
cutting into the sky. In this song, they talk about how even hatred will surrender to wonder. She is breaking my heart apart like a stubborn puzzle of problems. Even the hardest doubts and sorrows give way to her infinite grace. And who knew that sometimes grace can come from standing in the wind until everything we think we own is ripped away from us and replaced with a weightlessness so profound that we can't not cry. Tears of absolute praise and run all around the riverbanks, shouting to the cattails and the minnows and the crawdads about the truth of beauty. About the truth of a God that breathes through the trees. The truth of a God that weaves winter from water and night. The truth of a God that weaves bodies from dust and light and carries us down the river of life over and over until we finally understand the meaning of forever. In the language of the stones, there is no word for mistake, only the complete understanding of what it means to be a beloved son or daughter. We are the rock, and God is the water.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed episode 4 of Regeneration Rising Series 2. If this episode has inspired your thinking, please check out the show notes for links and resources, and to find out how you can be part of the regeneration.
My mother's medicine lives in the earth, rising from the ashes as we remember. I can hear her songs running through my veins.